The World is supported by Israel Story, a podcast that tells extraordinary stories about regular people living in Israel, the kind you won't see on the news or online. The show kicked off season four with a miniseries called The Wall, beginning with the gorgeous tale of a Jewish Arab baby born at the Western Wall in the middle of the Six-Day War. Hosted by Mishy Harman and brought to you by Tablet Magazine and PRX. Subscribe to Israel Story on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, israelstory.org, or wherever you listen to podcasts.
When war gets personal, an aid worker in northern Syria comes to terms with the loss of one of his team.
We just drove quickly through the fire and got behind a building, and we could see where the three wounded were, and the Kurds ran out to grab them, and I drove my ambulance up to get them. Gonzalez said, tank, tank, and it opened up at us.
Also, air pollution choking India's capital.
Delhi resembled a scene from some sort of a dystopian science fiction movie because you could see buildings disappearing into the smog, people walking with masks on their face.
And a new winner for rugby's World Cup, a tough sport where big men get to shove.
Basically, push hard against each other like two wild animals.
The toil and recovery make for long tournaments. I'm Marco Werman. Those stories and more today here on The World. We're starting to learn what was said actually behind those closed doors. Congressional investigators released detailed transcripts this afternoon from witnesses in the impeachment inquiry. It's just a start as the impeachment investigation moves into a public phase. For his part, President Donald Trump says there's, quote, no reason to investigate further. The World's Matthew Bell is here to explain.
We're seeing in full, these are the first two transcripts from some of the many U.S. officials who have gone behind closed doors, as you mentioned, to answer questions from members of the House committee that are conducting this impeachment inquiry. Remember that the Republicans have, and along with President Trump, have complained mightily that this process from the beginning has been conducted in secret. Well, we're now seeing things shift to a more public inquiry. This is the beginning of that. Just today, these two transcripts add up to more than 400 pages of material.
Yeah, and what are the highlights from these two transcripts that were released?
So the first is from Marie Yovanovitch. She served as U.S. ambassador to Ukraine. She was removed back in the spring by the Trump administration. In the 300 pages of testimony from her, the thing that really jumped out to me was that Yovanovitch describes to the House investigators how President Trump, along with his personal lawyer, Rudy Giuliani, were essentially running a shadow foreign policy in Ukraine, and that she was really kept out of it. This was irregular, to say the least. This is just not how U.S. foreign policy is conducted traditionally. Yovanovitch says she was troubled by what was going on here, being kept out of the loop. Today, Adam Schiff, the chairman of the House Intelligence Committee, he's essentially the point man on the impeachment inquiry for the Democrats. He described Marie Yovanovitch as a dedicated public servant and someone with decades of experience in the State Department.
It is someone who also is one of the first witnesses to this irregular back channel that the president established with Rudy Giuliani and the damage that it was doing to America's national security and foreign policy interests, how it was working at in opposition, not in support of U.S. policy objectives.
Another thing, Marco, that Schiff highlighted was that Yovanovitch was pressured through what he called a smear campaign, that she was pushed out of her role at the State Department. And that is something that the House needs to learn about.
And the transcript from the other witness, who was that witness and what did we learn there?
So that's Michael McKinley. He's a former advisor to Secretary of State Mike Pompeo. McKinley said that morale at the State Department among Foreign Service professionals was damaged by the way that the Trump administration had been carrying out U.S. foreign policy, that the administration was not supporting State Department personnel, even as they were getting caught up in this impeachment inquiry. That led McKinley, he says, to resign. He also said that he was disturbed by the Trump administration appearing to use ambassadors like Yovanovitch overseas in efforts that were trying to advance the Trump administration's domestic political objectives. Here's a line that really jumped out at me from McKinley's testimony. He says, I was disturbed by the implication that foreign governments were being approached to procure negative information on political opponents.
Wow. So more transcripts to come. What are we likely to hear this week?
It looks like two more transcripts will come out tomorrow in full, and these were from two of the biggest witnesses so far, and that was Kurt Volker, who is the Trump administration's special envoy to Ukraine, along with Gordon Sondland. He, remember, is the Trump supporter who became – he's a political appointee, became the ambassador to the European Union. Both Volker and Sondland, they testified and shed some light on what had happened with Ukraine policy, but they were also very much involved with what was going on there. Another thing, Marco, is that the president has called for the whistleblower to come forward and saying that the whistleblower's identity should be revealed. The Democrats are saying that's entirely inappropriate, but news came out today that the whistleblower's lawyer said that he would be willing to answer questions from the Republicans if that would satisfy them.
There was Matthew Bell. Thanks very much for keeping us up to date.
Thanks, Marco.
Northern Syria remains a hotbed of fighting. It's mainly between Kurdish soldiers and Syrian militia backed by Turkey. American troops, as you know, are out. So are most international humanitarian groups. But the Free Burma Rangers remain. The NGO's aid workers drive ambulances to the front lines. We reached the founder of the group, David Eubank, at his base at a hospital in Taltamir, Syria. He's actually mourning the loss of one of his team members, Zhao Song, a Burmese humanitarian worker who was killed on Sunday. I asked Eubank what happened to his colleague.
We heard that there was three wounded Kurdish soldiers that were holding off the onslaught, and we moved up to get them and found other soldiers fleeing because the attack was too heavy with armor. But we just drove quickly through the fire and got behind a building, and we could see where the three wounded were, and the Kurds ran out to grab them, and I drove my ambulance up to get them. And Zhao said, tank, tank, and it opened up at us six times and missed. We got all the wounded in our vehicle. They shot us machine guns, RPGs.
Medic in here!
Medic! Medic!
And kept missing us.
Give me the car!
Give me the car!
Zhao filmed the whole thing. That was the day before yesterday. Then yesterday, we were further back at a casualty collection point we set up and had taken care of two wounded from mortar strikes. And Zhao was working on that video from the day before that we wanted to send out to show the fighting and show the rescue. And he was working in the vehicle, which we have an armored ambulance, there's a couple of them. He was working in it. When he got done, he sat down outside the vehicle behind the wheel well with his back towards the enemy, but with the vehicle protecting him in a relatively safe place. I got in the vehicle with his laptop, and that's when, we don't know, it was a drone or a mortar round, landed 7 yards from us and killed Zhao instantly. Mohammed, who was wounded six times next to me in the Battle of Mosul, who recovered, was also wounded. He has about 30 small fragments in him, but he's okay. And our vehicle is heavily damaged, but it could move. So we evacuated Zhao, but he was dead at the moment. And the Kurds knew he was dead in the hospital, but out of their respect for us, out of their love, we gave him CPR, oxygen, adrenaline, electric shock, everything long after he was dead. And that really touched me that they kept trying, and I was praying for a miracle.
I gather he was kind of an uncle to your kids back in Burma, Dave. How did you meet Zhao?
Yes, he was an uncle. And in fact, when I called my daughter, my oldest daughter, who's now 19, she's known Zhao since she's like three. She just let out... She let out this big scream. No, 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 Zhao. He raised my kids. I'm sorry. He raised my kids.
I'm sorry.
And they love him. He's always laughing and always joking and just funny guy. And his relationship to me was, okay, it's dangerous. We got to go help these people. We got to do this. No one has to go. And he looks at me and he goes, where are you going? I said, I'm going. He goes, I go with you. That's how he was.
I mean, can you help us understand why this citizen of Burma, Zhao Song, he traveled halfway around the world to follow you and your NGO to help out those injured on the Syria-Turkish border? Why?
He said, because people have helped me in our struggle for freedom, I want to give back. You know, Burma's 70 years of civil war. His people have been under attack constantly. And he said, I want to help people, and I know how to do it. I'm only an okay medic, but I can shoot photos and tell a story. And I believe that this story is the most powerful weapon we can have to put a light on real human beings in real trouble. And I want to motivate people to help them. And so first it was the Yazidis trapped on Sinjar Mountain. We were up there together. And then it was the Battle of Mosul, which he followed the whole thing and did a lot of the filming. And then it was the situation of ISIS here in Syria. He just felt, I've been given a lot. I'm going to go. And the only time he slowed down was when he got married last year. And he waited till his child was born, and then he joined us again.
I have to ask you this, Dave. It's kind of a tough question, but does Zhao's death give you pause about your own efforts to follow your own courageous path with others beside you?
Oh, yeah. I feel totally responsible. I brought him here. I brought him everywhere. He trusts me. We were in a dangerous area. I mean, the people that killed him were the Turks and their proxies, the Free Syrian Army, that's sure. The people that allowed to have them was our government, that's sure. But I'm the one who brought him in to help people. And so I feel that responsibility, and I feel a deep sorrow. It's, of course, it's dangerous. It's very dangerous for them. We've lost some. They've lost thousands.
Are you seeing or hearing anything about U.S. troops close to where you are in this border area?
Well, we saw them drive away, which was a horrible feeling, and I'm sure they feel terrible. One day we went to do a rescue at a hospital, and the irony was watching the Americans go away from us when we needed their help and watching their attack helicopter gunships fly support over their convoys they left as we went pretty much naked in to go help people in a really bad place.
David Eubank heads the Free Burma Rangers, a humanitarian group that's providing frontline medical care on the Syria-Turkey border. Dave, thank you. And again, our condolences to you on the death of your colleague, Zhao Song.
Thank you. And I'm so glad you get the news out.
Serious rugby fan withdrawal today. 4 more years until the next World Cup tournament. But if you watch this year's tournament in Japan, you got your money's worth. You always do, because the Rugby World Cup takes a long time. Here's the world's Jessica Yarmosky.
Over the weekend, South African rugby fans counted down the final moments. After a month and a half, the Rugby World Cup was theirs. Yep, a 6-week tournament. For comparison, soccer's World Cup lasts only a month. And March Madness, men's college basketball, starts with 64 teams and crowns a champion 20 days later. Meanwhile, the Rugby World Cup takes nearly 3 times as long and starts with only a third of the teams. Turns out there's a reason rugby tournaments take forever. Players are crushing each other without pads at full speed for 80 minutes. They also spend a lot of time shoving each other in shows of brute force.
The biggest players of both teams get together and basically push hard against each other, like two wild animals.
Andrew Gray is a physical performance manager for a professional rugby team in Sydney. Part of his job is figuring out how players exert themselves throughout long matches and how long they need to recover.
There's probably an initial 3-day inflammatory period post all of that collision. And then you really need to get yourself in a state where you can train and prepare for the next opponent, which as a bare minimum is probably another 2 or 3 days.
It's not just the physical aspects. Gray also spends a lot of time exploring the mental load rugby players have to take on.
The amount of sleep that you get, the travel that you get, the load comprises all of those things.
So at the World Cup, most players are in a different time zone, doing interviews with media back home, sleeping in unfamiliar places. It's a bit like the Olympics, but that's only 2 weeks. Again, the Rugby World Cup is 6. But the South Africans fought through it all. They crushed England in the final this weekend, 32-12. Captain Siya Kolisi spoke after the win in Tokyo.
We know we come from different backgrounds, different races, and we came together with one goal, and we wanted to achieve it. I really hope that we've done that for South Africa to show that we can pull together if we want to work to and we achieve something.
Quite an achievement, even if it took forever. For the world, I'm Jessica Yarmosky.
Farmers in parts of Australia are having a great day. Thanks to a series of rainstorms this weekend. Even farmers' kids were celebrating. Australia is seeing one of its longest dry spells. The drought in New South Wales began in mid-2017 with farms hit especially hard. But then this weekend, more than 3.5 inches of rain all at once.
Cows and kids all excited for the rain.
The drought is far from over, but at least for now, a little relief and some joy. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Starting today, a federal court is hearing from plaintiffs who argue the U.S. is not a safe place for asylum seekers. That court is in Toronto, in Canada. And as Emma Jacobs reports, they're challenging what's known as a Safe Third Country Agreement.
The U.S. and Canada signed the Safe Third Country Agreement in 2002. It says people who arrive in either country looking for asylum should apply in the country they arrive in first. So if an asylum seeker makes it to the U.S., then goes to a border crossing with Canada and says they want to apply for asylum there, they can be turned back. Janet Dench with the Canadian Council for Refugees describes what can happen next.
Unless they have a visa that gives them right to be in the United States, they have a very strong risk of being detained in the United States.
Her group is among the plaintiffs asking a Canadian court to strike down the agreement because, they argue, asylum seekers who are turned back could face harsh detention conditions in the U.S., potentially held in the same jails as people who've committed crimes. So while this case may be taking place in Canada, it's the U.S. immigration system that's on trial, explains Craig Damian Smith. He's with the Global Migration Lab at the University of Toronto.
The fundamental question in front of the courts is whether or not Canada should, given the policy changes under the Trump administration, consider the U.S. a safe country for asylum seekers, or whether we're breaching people's rights and breaching our responsibilities and obligations under the Refugee Convention.
A spokesperson for Canada's Immigration and Refugee Agency said they can't comment on an ongoing court case. But in its legal argument filed with the court, the Canadian government says the U.S. has a highly developed asylum system that grants protection to large numbers of people every year. And the government argues that many of the Trump administration's most criticized policies at the southern U.S. border, like separating families and making people wait for their asylum hearings in Mexico, don't apply to people turned back from Canada. Janet Dench is not convinced.
We're talking about someone who comes to the Canadian border, who asks for Canada's protection, and we cannot wash our hands of that responsibility saying, oh, well, it's not a big deal because there were other people that received refugee protection in the United States.
Back in 2017, we spoke to a man from Nigeria named Precious at a refugee shelter in Montreal. He and his family had fled Nigeria hoping to get asylum in the U.S., but he said they did not see a clear path to legal status there.
We're living under fear of deportation by the present immigration policy of U.S.
Believing they had a better chance of getting asylum in Canada, Precious and his family walked across the border between official points of entry, sort of a loophole, because the Safe Third Country Agreement only applies to people appearing at official crossings.
God bless Canada, because, it's a place where our fears have been relieved for now.
Tens of thousands of people have walked across the border in the countryside, avoiding official points of entry since 2017. That's brought political backlash from some Canadians who see this as rule-breaking and cutting in line. Some immigrant advocates told me that if the Safe Third Country Agreement is overturned, it could reduce hostility towards refugees because people like Precious would go to official border crossings. But Smith of the Global Migration Lab isn't so sure. He says if a Canadian court were to decide that the U.S. is not a safe country for refugees and throw out the agreement, that could encourage large numbers of people to come from the U.S. to Canada, though there's no guarantee they'd get asylum.
As a political scientist who's been studying the politics of irregular migration around the world, I also think that Canadians could use a dose of political realism.
In other words, he says, overturning the Safe Third Country Agreement would be a win for refugee rights in the short term. But if it makes Canadians worry about refugee numbers, it could lead to less welcoming policies in the future. For The World, Emma Jacobs, Montreal.
This fall, a grad student at Yale University has been pulling double duty, working on his PhD and working to get his mother released from an immigrant detention center.
In general, my mother has been the main sort of supporter in all of my efforts. In my high school, my mom worked multiple jobs to keep a roof over our heads, to make sure I was able to do the extracurricular activities that helped me sort of prepare for college.
Christian Padilla Romero was born in Honduras but grew up in Atlanta. He and his siblings have protected status under DACA, Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, an Obama-era program. Christian's mother is undocumented and was detained during a traffic stop in August. Now at Yale, students are fundraising and organizing phone banks to call immigration officials and help her out. I asked Christian how he feels about the response.
It's very incredible to me, also to my mother. It's just, I think people see the cruelty that's happening to a lot of people. And I guess my mom is becoming a representation of that. My mom is not the only one in that center. You know, there's hundreds of people there, there's other centers. Yeah, it's really incredible. I mean, I tell my mom every time I speak to her about how much support we're getting, the events. People are just taking the initiative to build awareness about what's going on.
So how often have you actually been able to speak with her since she's been detained?
Pretty much daily. One of the benefits I'm sure has helped her is that we add funds to her phone allotment, but there's also a video call options now. The pricing is about the same. So we do talk to her daily, just, you know, keep her updated with our lives and everything. Physical visits are a little bit more difficult because the detention center she's in is about 3.5 hours from Atlanta. And so we can only visit once a week, and it's only a maximum of 2 adults and 3 children. So usually my siblings and I take turns each weekend. Since coming to school, though, I haven't seen her in over a month.
So she's been in detention since August. I know one of the reasons you're so worried about your mom is because she's sick with cancer. When was she diagnosed?
She was diagnosed in late 2017, and she had major surgery, basically. It cut across from the back of her left side of the neck all the way down to the right side. And then right after, she had chemotherapy and radiation sessions for a couple months. By late 2017, she was considered cancer-free, and she's been in remission ever since. Her health has been still at a very fragile point. You know, like, she hasn't regained much of her weight still. Her mouth in general has very limited mobility because of the surgery and the radiation. And among other things, you know, since being there, she's developed a vitamin B12 deficiency, which has made her very weak and lose energy. And, you know, she didn't receive treatment for that, even though doctors or staff there were the ones who diagnosed it. And they said they were going to give her something, and they never really did until later, when one of my aunts was like, you need to do something. So that's when I finally contacted our attorney and said, you know, my mom hasn't received any sort of medication for this deficiency for weeks, if not over a month. You know, it is a private detention center, so there's just less accountability on their part. And once the attorney did make the request, I think they were quick in following up. But, you know, it did require that sort of active approach from our part. That's one of the things that has us really worried.
Meantime, Christian, what is next for you and your family? And are you optimistic that the phone banking will get you some positive results?
The phone banking is one of many tactics that we're taking on. You know, public support has been really great. Our petition, it's almost at 30,000, if not there yet. We do have a Congresswoman McBath's office directly in contact with ICE regarding her situation. And so our hope is for her to be released so she can see the medical care she needs. You know, she missed her oncological appointment in September because she was detained. We're very optimistic. I think the support that we've gathered hopefully will result in her release and everything that we're asking for.
Christian Padilla Romero is a PhD candidate at Yale University. His mother is in ICE detention in Georgia. Thanks very much for telling us your family's story.
No, thank you.
What do Goldman Sachs experts and leading thinkers have to say about trending shaping markets, industries, and the global economy? And what macroeconomic issues are on the minds of our clients? Listen to Goldman Sachs podcasts to find out. Available at www.gs.com/podcasts or any of your favorite podcast platforms.
Artist Sanjay Patel grew up in California in an immigrant family in a home filled with Hindu gods from India.
My parents' deities, those images, weren't working for me.
So Patel modernized the Hindu gods, and now Netflix is turning them into a children's series.
They're all superheroes.
Hindu superheroes, coming up here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, WGBH Boston, PRI, and PRX. The air in Delhi was so bad over the weekend, it was like smoking more than 2 packs of cigarettes in a day. Air pollution in India's capital was roughly 60 times greater than the global safety threshold. The haze is creating a public health hazard. The poor visibility is also delaying flights and snarling traffic. It is a problem across northern India. Mudita Dua is a pediatrician in a small city about 100 miles north of Delhi. She told us about eye and lung problems with children.
All those children who had pre-existing asthma, they are coming with exacerbations and so much severe that they need hospitalization. And even children whose lungs are healthy, and even a newborn or even an infant who was healthy before, are coming constantly coughing.
Dr. Dua is worried about that constant coughing. At the hospital where she works, there was so much smoke yesterday that it repeatedly set off fire alarms for 2 hours. It's even worse in the capital. The BBC's Pratiksha Gildial joins us from New Delhi. So how bad is this pollution? What does it actually look like right now?
So, Marco, today was slightly better than yesterday and the day before when I went out reporting. Delhi resembled a scene from some sort of a dystopian science fiction movie because you could see buildings disappearing into the smog, people walking with masks on their face, and there was a real putrid sort of smell in the air which was causing an itch in your throat and your eyes were burning. It's slightly better today, but the air quality is still quite severe, so Delhi residents are still breathing highly toxic air.
So if you can feel it in your throat, I imagine you can taste it. What does it taste like?
Slightly putrid, it kind of smells like something is burning. And if you look around you because of the smog, it looks like Delhi is on fire. And a major reason of that is the farmers in the neighboring states of Haryana and Punjab, they burn their crop stubble every year. And as a result of that, the smoke from there travels to Delhi and just hovers here for days.
Is it just those agricultural emissions from burning fields, or are there other things in the air like motor vehicle emissions or anything else?
Absolutely. This is just one of the reasons, though it is said to be a major one. But of course, there's vehicular pollution. There is construction activities, which causes a lot of dust to settle in the air. And especially during winter time, it gets trapped in the heavy, thick air and just like stays there for days on end. The government says it's doing what it can really to solve the problem. They have shut down schools for a few days so children don't go out. They've banned construction activities, and starting today, they have launched a scheme whereby from today until the 15th of November, only cars with either odd or even number plates will be allowed on the roads each day. So every alternate day, depending on whether your car has an odd or an even number plate, will your private car be allowed on the road. But whether this will actually make any difference in bringing down the pollution levels remains to be seen.
Pratiksha, have experts suggested any reasons for why things are a little bit better today?
Every year, there are days which are really bad. There are days which are slightly better. And I think a lot of it depends on the winds, whether, there's enough wind to help scatter that thick smog. There was also a little bit of rain which helped. But the biggest thing which is causing a lot of anger here among residents is this inability of the entire political class to deal with it collectively.
Yeah, which is kind of stunning because, isn't this fairly predictable? A lot of this pollution comes with seasonal weather patterns. Government has a short-term solution. Children stay inside, no construction. But what will prompt the government to break this political paralysis? Another really bad pollution episode, worse than this year?
Well, a lot of people, half jokingly say it will become an important issue for politicians, and it will become an electoral issue once the rich start getting severely affected. Well, they say it in jest, but it is true that if you look at the most vulnerable in the city, they are people who work on the streets, like traffic police, like tuk-tuk drivers, public
the,
transport
the auto rickshaw drivers, yeah.
Exactly, auto rickshaw drivers, public transport drivers, and not to mention the tens of thousands of homeless people on Delhi's streets who just can't escape this. And then there are the kids. Their lungs are not sufficiently developed, and studies after studies have shown that kids born in Delhi have reduced lung function. So it's an entire generation of Indians who's having to grow up in these conditions.
The BBC's Pratiksha Gildial in New Delhi. Thank you very much. Stay safe.
Thank you, Marco.
As we just heard, farmers burning off the remnants of crops. It's a leading cause of Delhi smog. At its peak last week, nearly half of the particulate matter choking the city came from fires on nearby farms. The World's environment correspondent Carolyn Beeler joins me now. So you've been looking at some possible solutions to Delhi's smog problem and why things seem to be getting worse.
This is a story of unintended consequences. So here's a bit of the backstory about why the smog is so bad right now. Farmers in Northwest India plant rice in the summer. Rice takes a lot of water. Groundwater scarcity started to be an issue up there. So in 2009, authorities in two northwestern Indian states passed laws requiring farmers to delay the planting of their rice to take advantage of monsoon season rains and conserve water. But when you delay planting, you delay the harvest, and you delay the burning that farmers often do to clear this rice straw from their farms to allow for planting of wheat. So you're condensing all this burning, and you're also pushing it later in the season, when temperatures are lower in Delhi and winds are less strong, which means that the smog created by these fires all happening at once is more likely to hang over Delhi, which is what's happening right now.
So thanks for that backstory, but what is being done to try to stop the burning and cleaning up the air quality in Delhi right now?
Well, burning crops is already illegal, but what farmers really need is a cheap, efficient alternative to burning to clear their crops to prepare to plant that wheat. So one alternative that's been in development for a while is this attachment to a tractor called a happy seeder that basically scrapes up rice straw, plants wheat seeds, and then puts the rice straw back on top of those seeds as a kind of mulch or compost.
But these machines are expensive, and most of the farming class is not able to afford them.
So that was Avikul Senwashi, the program manager for the Center for Science and Environment, which is an environmental think tank in Delhi.
The government of India has put in a substantial amount of money to make these machines available. But given the scale of how many farmers are there, it is not sufficient.
These happy seeder machines are being used on only about a fifth of the farmland in northwest India. But proponents are hoping that through greater government subsidies and other measures, they can increase that substantially in coming years.
So the really bad smog that comes around this time of year in Delhi, it's partly driven by the problem we've been talking about, burning crops. But that's really only a big part of the problem for a couple of weeks each year, right? So how are authorities trying to tackle pollution year-round?
So year-round, the largest cause of smog in Delhi is the transportation sector. So Delhi's already instituted a fee for freight, you know, heavy vehicles to encourage them to bypass the city. And right now, it's started to limit car use in the city. But it's not really seriously talking about congestion pricing, which is a solution that's been shown to work. So here's one example, a case study, if you will. London recently instituted a new ultra-low emission zone, which requires drivers to either meet strict emission requirements or pay a lot to drive into central London. And in its first 6 months in effect, that reduced nitrogen oxide, which is a key ingredient of smog, by about a third.
Yeah. So is there any talk of passing like that London law in Delhi in India?
It's been talked about, but not very seriously. What looks slightly more likely to happen is a fee on parking street side in downtown Delhi. It is not politically popular, just like a lot of measures to prevent smog are, like we just heard from our BBC colleague Pratiksha Gildial. But the environmentalist I talked to in Delhi, Avikul Senwashi, says he's holding out hope that this current smog might just change that.
So I believe that this smog episode will actually build public opinion to take some unpopular measures.
I'm sure that's what a lot of people in Delhi are hoping for today. The World's Environment Correspondent Carolyn Beeler, thanks very much.
You're welcome.
In other environmental news, the Trump administration started the formal withdrawal process from the Paris Climate Change Agreement today. It'll be finalized in 1 year, the day after the U.S. presidential election. Picture this, an animated show for kids where the main characters are Hindu gods, but the gods are preschoolers in a class together. That's the premise of a new show called Ghee Happy that's been greenlit by Netflix. It's part of a push by Netflix to diversify its programming for children. The World's Rupa Shenoy spoke with the creator of Ghee Happy and the Netflix executive who commissioned the show.
We spoke by FaceTime. There was only room for one person in front of their camera, so Sanjay Patel and Dominique Baze kept shoving it toward each other.
This is mostly about Sanjay, so we can have you look into here. There you go.
Patel was a Disney and Pixar animator, working on Monsters, Inc., Cars 2, and The Simpsons. He'd grown up in California with Indian Gujarati parents.
They created essentially a mini bubble of frozen time from the 70s of India in this little house. You know, and I was reared in that.
As a kid, he sort of resented Hinduism. He blamed it for his inability to fit in. So as an adult, he returned to it in his graphic artwork. And after a Pixar executive saw one of his graphics on display, Patel directed a short animated film. Sanjay's Super Team reimagines the mornings from Patel's own childhood when he had to join his father in prayers.
I finally had figured out a way to essentially fuse these two sides of me together. And it was really having to study their world and remake it into a world that fit my own.
In the film, the Sanjay character falls into a world where he's protected by gods. The film was nominated for an Academy Award. Patel also wrote and illustrated children's books about Hindu gods. And someone gave those books to Dominique Bazé at Netflix.
I just became completely obsessed with his graphic style. And I thought, it's almost like they're all superheroes. We got in touch and we started talking, and I just was struck that new parents living outside of their cultures who are having to kind of share experiences with their kids, but don't have a lot of tools to do that.
At the time, Patel was becoming more and more fascinated with Indian miniature paintings from 3,000 years ago and the way artists used a flat perspective.
I really do feel like I am kind of carrying that same idea forward, but with the lens of just trying to distill things down to its essence.
The new Netflix show is still in production. It uses that style and reimagines Hindu deities as preschoolers learning to gain their powers in a daycare called Ghee Happy. It's a result of Patel's newest phase in life, being a father to two boys.
I was watching a ton of preschool, and I was like, oh man, there's so many great preschool shows, but I was also noticing that there wasn't a lot of great shows that spoke to us as a blended family. My wife is Caucasian American. It just felt like, well, golly, maybe I need to remake culture again to make it fit for my kids as well as us as a family and their friends.
But there's also a political aspect to Hinduism on the world stage right now. Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi, who endorsed President Trump, is from a Hindu nationalist party, and that party is accused of persecuting minorities. In addition, critics worry Ghee Happy might minimize problems like Hindu caste inequality. Patel says he has thought about the political implications.
For sure I have. I have lots of friends who are social justice brown warriors. They're like, Patel, what are you doing? This, that, and the other thing. Or they're poking at me and they're asking really important and timely questions. And what I will say is I'm in no way, shape, form political.
But Patel says he's made sure that at least one Ghee Happy show has the main characters talking to neighbors of different cultures. I also asked Bazé about Netflix's responsibility to think about the political implications of Hinduism. She's their director of international original animation.
I think it is something that we have to think about, but my deep conviction is that telling diverse stories and giving voices to a deep, deep set of artists will make this world a better place. Our members are all over the world, and I think the kids' business has been really centered around Anglo-Saxon stories. We have this incredible opportunity with this platform to reach people everywhere. So our stories can come from anywhere.
But she acknowledges that the process of making that happen is challenging.
This is rare for us to have these kinds of conversations, so it's exciting to have it. It is really hard. It's not easy to do. You have to trust, you have to take risks, and you have to invest in talent that maybe don't have the expertise to deliver. The beauty of our job at Netflix on the kids team and the reason why we've decided to really reach outside of the U.S. to tell stories is precisely to tell authentic stories to kids.
Because Bazé says kids' programming is getting more and more generic.
Everything is sort of based in Nowhere's Town, and these characters are sort of like all the same skin tone, and we're really leaning into a time in the world where kids need to see themselves. And it's a mix of strategy and responsibility. We know that amazing stories for kids come from everywhere.
And audiences anywhere might watch. Bazé says, so far, it's been tough to predict.
We launched our Diwali special, a show called Mighty Little Beam, that's entirely animated in India. Basically, the creators are in India. And it was originally thought that the show would really be relevant to Indian kids. And it just became wildly popular outside of India. And that was, to us, a great signal that there's really an appetite for stories that come from everywhere.
Now, Baze says, it's Netflix's responsibility to go to those places and find more of those stories. For The World, I'm Rupa Shenoy.
All right, I love a good cookie, but what about these new cookies that are out of this world, literally? The World's Sarah Birnbaum has more.
When I was a little kid, I wanted to be an astronaut. But then one day I tried that freeze-dried space food in class, and I thought, never mind. Ian Fichtenbaum from the company Zero G Kitchen says space food has improved a little since the 80s when I was a kid, but not that much.
They have things that are freeze-dried, they do have a warmer, and they do have a hydrator.
So a hydrator, so that would mean that they take freeze-dried food and you inject moisture into it to make it not freeze-dried?
Yeah, and there's some videos out there where they take an asparagus patty and they it adds water and they eat from there.
So Ian and his wife and business partner, Jordana Fichtenbaum, thought, what if astronauts could bake chocolate chip cookies in space?
You're going to want to prepare food in space.
Freshly baked food.
That's also a morale thing. So
you can't do it from scratch because you can't have all that flour flying around. And can you imagine cracking an egg in space? Yuck. So Ian and Jordana had pre-made dough sent to space, and then they designed a special zero-gravity oven with the Texas-based company NanoRacks. Mary Murphy is a manager there.
So one of the biggest challenges with cooking in space is when you think about cooking here on the ground, a lot of cooking is based on convection.
So basically on Earth, ovens have a heating coil or gas burner on the bottom that heats up the air in the oven. So then the hot air rises, the cold air rushes in to take its place, and then that heats up and rises, and pretty soon all the air in the oven gets hot.
And that's actually a function of gravity. When we go to the microgravity environment of space, we don't have that fundamental factor working with us.
So the space oven uses a bunch of equally spaced coils that heat up a pocket in the middle of the oven, and that's where the cookies go. But don't the cookies just float inside the oven? Turns out Ian and Jordana thought of that too. The cookies are individually wrapped in a silicone pouch, and then the pouch is fitted into an oven rack.
Think of just like a silicone pouch that's completely surrounded by a picture frame.
The space oven arrived at the space station this morning, and it will probably take a couple of days to install. And after that, it should only be a matter of time before the smell of freshly baked cookies fills the International Space Station. Of course, no one knows what the cookies will actually look like. They could pop out like little balls or stay flat like hockey pucks. But then again, you never know how my cookies will turn out either. And I have the benefit of gravity. For The World, I'm Sarah Birnbaum.
Joining me now in the studio is The World's Bianca Hillier. Bianca, do you know how hot that zero gravity oven in space gets?
I do, Marco. The oven heats up to 350 degrees.
That's kind of uncanny. How do you know that?
I know that because I've been working on The World's new smart speaker series, which we launched today. It's called The Number in the News, and it's a show tailored just for smart speakers. It sounds like this. I'm Bianca Hillier. This is The Number in the News. Today's number, 38.
That is very cool, Bianca. So smart speakers, these are devices like the Amazon Echo and Google Home. How can I actually listen to The Number in the News?
If you have a Google device, you can say, OK, Google, play news from The Number in the News.
Play news from The Number in the News, just like that.
Right. Or just add it to the Google Home app. And if you have an Amazon device, you can add The Number in the News to your flash briefing. And voila, Alexa will speak to you.
From The World, this is The Number in the News.
More information on how to add The Number in the News to your smart speaker is at the top of our Twitter page. We are at PRI The World. And let us know what you think. Email smartspeaker@theworld.org with your feedback. That's smartspeaker@theworld.org. The Number in the News is available now on Amazon and Google smart speakers. Bianca, thanks very much for being with us.
Thanks, Marco.
As for the number 38, it's about time. If you want to know more, call out the number in the news. Okay, I got a number for you, 80. That's the length in feet of an iron schooner trapped in the river that dumps into Niagara Falls, trapped there for about 100 years, until last week when torrential rains dislodged the schooner to a shallow area but closer to the falls. The backstory is even more interesting, and who better to tell us than Jim Hill? He's in charge of heritage at the Niagara Parks Commission. Hey, Jim, where are you right now?
Well, I'm standing right next to the river. I'm about 200 yards from the wreck of the scow.
So take us back to 1918. How did it get stuck in the first place?
Well, there was an awful lot of hydroelectric development going on in the first two decades here at Niagara Falls. And they were working on the hydro canal on the New York side, actually. And the scow was filled with sand or rocks, and it was being towed out into the upper river to dump its load. And the tug that was towing it hit an obstacle, and the scow broke loose. But it had men on board, a fellow named James Harris and Gustav Lofberg. And they had to figure out how to get these guys off of the scow.
Yeah, how did that happen? That must have been quite a story.
Well, it's a great story of cooperation. Somebody called down to the U.S. Coast Guard station in Youngstown, New York, and the guys there had a rescue cannon.
Yeah, so a rescue cannon is exactly what it sounds like, kind of like one of those cartoon things you might find in Roadrunner, where you shoot a line out and you use that to rescue the stranded.
Yeah, absolutely. But then they ran into some difficulty, and this is where some heroics come into it. The line got tangled. And at this point, there were dozens of men standing on the roof of this power plant. And the power plant was guarded by the Canadian Army because World War I was still going on.
Right.
But a local gentleman who'd just come back from the war, who'd been wounded over there, a fellow named William Hill Sr., who went by the nickname of Red Hill, he volunteered to go out on the lines and untangle them. He got them partially untangled, but when he got back to the power plant, they just tangled up again. And then the sun went down. So when the sun came back up in the morning, it was Red Hill who volunteered again, and he went out, untangled the lines, and the two men were successfully rescued.
Wow. When the rescue happened in 1918, as you said, I mean, this was World War I. I mean, that must have been a nice bit of good news for the time.
I think you're absolutely right. There was so much bad news coming from Europe, and here was news of two men whose lives were saved and could go back to their families. So it's sort of a story that is near and dear to the hearts of local people and stands out as a great example of friends on both sides of the river working together to help these guys and rescue them.
Jim Hill is in charge of heritage at the Niagara Parks Commission. Thank you very much for being with us and telling us about the Iron Scout.
Well, thank you, Marco.
Hanging on for 100 years in the rapids, that boat is an inspiration. From the Nan and Bill Harris studio at WGBH here in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. We'll see you back here tomorrow.
The World is a co-production of WGBH Boston, the BBC World Service, PRI, and PRX.